And this letter that Paul has written to this young pastor Titus, that he's left on Crete to sort out what Paul had left unfinished, couldn't start more abruptly, really, than it does in verse 1. Because he's been very clear that living out what it means to know Jesus Christ as Lord should bring a clear contrast between those who are Christians and the world. Paul doesn't beat about the bush with that at all. Right at the start of his letter, he's introduced himself. If you look at verse 1 and chapter 1, as serving God, literally being a slave of God, he says, he's happy to say that, and being sent, being an apostle sent by Jesus Christ. Firstly, he says, so that God's people may hear the truth to believe and be saved. And secondly, so that they may know the truth that leads to godliness. In other words, becoming like the precious Lord Jesus who died to save them. And you have to agree with that, don't you? The whole point of the good news of knowing Jesus Christ as Lord, responding to him as Saviour and Lord, means that, as the famous missionary martyr Jim Elliot put it, we have bargained with him who bore a cross. When we come to the cross, when we bow before Jesus Christ as Lord, as he dies for us, everything else that we may count to our credit is left behind. Because we're saying, Lord, I'm a sinner in need of forgiveness. And you have to agree that if only we would be more like him in character and attitude, in love and giving and sacrifice, in the way we treat one another and in our obedience to God, then our world would actually be a very different environment. And the Church of Jesus Christ, Christians across the world, would have a very much better reputation than sometimes, sadly, they do. Jesus Christ is Lord. That has big implications. And so throughout this letter, Paul unpacks the implications of that truth. And reminds them again and again that the world is watching. That is what the world is doing. Watching to see what it means actually to be a Christian. Whether it's just a lip service thing and a Sunday attendance thing and an occasional meeting thing. Or whether actually it plays out into the rest of our lives. Growing godliness is always going to be a huge contrast to the society around us. But Paul takes it further when he contrasts what Titus has to say to the people here in chapter 2 with the way he has to speak to the false teachers there in chapter 1. Just have a look back. We saw last week at the end of chapter 1 what they're like. He couldn't be any clearer than verse 16. These false teachers, these people whom Paul is concerned about, who've been dragging people off down the kind of religiosity where they somehow earn their way to heaven and somehow earn brownie points with God, let me put it like that. Well, Paul says people that do things like that, who teach others to do things like that, who deliberately twist the truth of the gospel and of the Bible for their own ends, they are detestable. It couldn't be much stronger this, could it, verse 16? They are detestable, they are disobedient, and they are unfit for doing anything good. So, says Paul, you must rebuke them sharply so that they stop teaching falsehood and start teaching truth. But in contrast, and that is the first point, contrast to them, well, Titus is to teach something entirely different. Chapter 2 and verse 1, you, Titus, in contrast to them, must teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. In fact, when Paul says teach there, the word in reality in the original language that this was written, other versions may have it, other English translations may have it, says that he's not just to teach them, he's to speak to them. To tell them what kind of behavior should result in their lives from having Jesus Christ as Lord. Let's just be clear before we go any further. The only thing that makes someone a Christian is faith in Jesus Christ as Lord. That is the only thing that makes you a Christian. You can't earn your way to heaven. You can't be a good person that will get you to heaven. You trust in what he has done, not in what you have done, not in what I have done. But having him as Lord, doing business, as it were, with the one who died on the cross, turning from repenting and turning from having me as king of my life to having Jesus king of my life, means that there is a change. It has big implications for me, the priorities I set and the way I think. There will be a change when someone becomes a Christian. And Paul is acutely aware of that. And he's also acutely aware that that change is being pulled all over the place by these false teachers he's mentioned in chapter 1. So he wants to be clear on what the change should be.
Over these next couple of weeks, we're going to explore what it means for people in the situation that Paul describes here in chapter 2. This week, he's going to deal with the older people in the church, and next week, he's going to deal with the younger people. Let me say to you, no preacher on a Sunday morning wakes up and thinks, I know, let's offend half of the congregation this week and be doubly offensive to the other half of the congregation next. And no preacher does that, but we work our way through books of the Bible, largely speaking, in this church, and we have to take the Bible seriously and put into practice what it says. And as we look at this, we're going to see that it has some both very challenging but also encouraging things to say to us. Don't, particularly those of you that have already written off next week because you think it's culturally bound and sexist, don't go merely by appearances. Come along, hear what it has to say, because I think particularly the ladies will be challenged, but the men likewise will be challenged as to how they respond to Jesus Christ being Lord. But this week, before those of us who are younger, or those of you who are younger, depending on your perspective, decide that they can switch off this morning, let me highlight two important points that I think are the reason that Paul starts with the older people. The first is an obvious one, is that Paul doesn't specify what he means by older. So I was deliberately ambiguous when I said those of us or those of you. He doesn't specify what he means by older. One commentator I've read on this insists that it's those over 60. I think that it is completely indefensible from the Bible, so we'll ignore what he has to say. Older just means older than the person who's younger than you. And secondly, that while some of us here this morning are no longer younger, all things being equal, all of us one day will be older. So therefore, even if you're young, you need to pay attention to this as to where you're going in the future. And just in case the older ones think that that means next week isn't for them and they don't bother and stay at home and go listen to the cricket or something, or come along this next Sunday morning and have a snooze, well, let me just challenge you that you're going to see next week that what happens next week largely depends on you. So please come, because all of us need to listen. Let's get in, therefore, to chapter 2 and what Paul has to unpack for us. It's staggering, you know, how often our society manages to take the broken and make it worthy of note. It happens in language all the time. We've mentioned this a number of times recently. So if, for example, you ask a young person these days to talk about something that we would, as those who are not very young, call fantastic, they would often say that it's really cool, or worse still, that it's really wicked, which is completely confusing, isn't it? In fact, what society does time and again is take what is broken and bad and turn it into something that is worthy of note. Here in Titus chapter 2, Paul begins with a ban in the church on what has entertainingly come to be known as grumpy old men. And what he says is that grumpy old men have no place as those who treat Jesus Christ as Lord. They should be godly and not grumpy old men. Let's look at verse 2 together. Teach the older men, Titus, to be temperate, worthy of respect, self-controlled and sound in faith, in love, and in endurance. In some ways, the character description of a godly older man actually has nothing particularly remarkable about it, does it? You might say that this is full of obviously Christian virtues. Out of interest, the list is almost identical to that which Paul lists in his first letter to Timothy for those who are elders and deacons. So the point is that older men somehow are to behave as those who are senior members of the Christian community. That is to say, they are to be examples. When you take this list that Paul puts here in verse 2 and try to apply the list to real life situations, then suddenly it's no longer a theoretical thing. The rubber, as it were, hits the road. You start to work out in practice what it means for them to be temperate and worthy of respect and so on. And suddenly it becomes a lot more painful and difficult to hear. You see, the reason for that is that though Job says wisdom should be found in those who are older, we all know from experience, don't we, that that is not always true. And those of us that are growing older, maybe some of us are approaching middle age, know very well that the main thing we learn is how much more we have to learn. The difficulty is, you see, that
if we can listen, as it were, for a moment to the other side of the telephone call that Paul is on. Remember, letters in the New Testament are always one side of the argument, and there's another side that we can that is inferred by what he has to say. If we can listen for a moment to the other side of the telephone call, we can see, well, we can see that there are challenges that are specific to older men. Well, we're going to get to you ladies in a moment. But just think for a moment what it is like to be an older man, those of us that are not. Men who are older are faced with a number of challenges that Paul is seeking to counteract and address. Firstly, men who are older have to come to terms with the fact that whatever mark they may ever have wanted to make on the world is either already made or is probably never going to be made. And they must come to terms with that. They must resolve somehow that their bodies are tired and that they're losing strength that one day they, once upon a time, they took pride in. Their sense of invincibility has gone. Their declining years will bring with it declining ability, maybe frailty, that once upon a time they would have laughed at. And they find themselves slowing down. And that's difficult to grasp. I've said already, the sense of invincibility has passed. And people don't invest in them as much as once they did. Nor listen to the plans which they bring along, which they can no longer be expected to carry out. Being an older man means taking less of a front seat in the world. And it's hard. Which is why the Grumpy Old Men program is so popular on TV. Because all of a sudden they've got much less positive to say and much more criticism to bring. And into that rather bleak situation, Paul says that having Jesus Christ as Lord will be a completely different response to the one that the world gives. Older men, he says, if you'll unpack verse 2 with me, must be temperate. That means sober. It is related to alcohol, but not directly. It means that they are men who can keep their head. They've had years to learn to do it, to keep their head, when all around them seems to be going nuts and blaming it on them, if I can change the poem slightly. These are men who can keep their head and not lose their temper on a mere trifle. And some of us are challenged by that. They are to be men who are worthy of respect. That is, they are to be serious. Now, just be very clear. When he says serious, he doesn't mean gloomy or grumpy. There is no place for grumpy old men who know Jesus Christ as Lord. But actually, it comes from the idea, the word comes from the idea of being worshipful. Let's just unpack that a little bit more. Older men are to be temperate. And worshipful. That is, those who claim to be Christian and have done business with Jesus as he's died on the cross, who have their sins forgiven, who name him as Lord, are to see themselves in their own eyes, not as strugglers who are now past it but wish they weren't and somehow are frustrated. Rather, as those whose experience teaches them calmness. Who see themselves as having their identity bound not in what they can achieve, but in their witness to Jesus as Lord, worshipful, conscious of their position before God. They are to be self-controlled, literally safe-minded or safe-hearted. That means they can be trusted not to lose it when everybody else is. It's related to temperate, but not just that. It means that when they meet with triumph, as well as disaster, well, they can be trusted not to lose their head in the moment, but to treat it calmly. Those two impostors just the same, again, to paraphrase Kipling. And perhaps most poignant of all, he says they are to be sound, literally healthy, in faith and in love, and in endurance. Older men who are challenged by themselves and by a world that seems to be increasingly beyond their grasp and beyond their control
Older Christian men are to have a healthy relationship towards God, sound in faith. Are to have a loving attitude to all, sound in love. And are to have a healthy endurance. That is, an endurance to the end. You may have encountered that before. Remember, Paul, as he writes to the Corinthians, says at the end of chapter 13, these three remain, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of those is love. It's the same triplet, it's the same triad, isn't it? Only he puts it in a slightly different order and phrases it differently. He says, faith, love, and endurance. Endurance, of course, really is hope worked out in practice. Endurance is motivated by hope and the internal life that knowing Jesus Christ as Lord will bring. Those who are older men, who find increasingly that the world is beyond their control, will find that the world, should find that the world they're looking forward to is not the one that is beyond their control, but is the world to come. They're to be settled in these and to live them out. Can I say humbly that if you are an older man, if you count yourself in that, can I be one who exhorts you to pray those virtues in and live them out? Why? Well, because you hold a key position amongst us as a Christian community, as examples for those who are to follow, not least the next group that Paul deals with, who might be described not, in fact, as older men, grumpy or not, but as older women, who are not empty in their lives and old age, but are fulfilled. You see, that's what he turns to next in verse 3, isn't it? Fulfilled and not empty old women. Again, we unpacked what it means to be an older man. But the challenges of older women are similar to those of men and yet different. Older women, and I obviously can't directly relate to being an older woman in any sense, but those I know who are, and the research I've done in the testimonies of those who are confirms this, that the challenges of older women are many. Perhaps most poignantly is that, like the men, their bodies have changed, reminding them in every conceivable way of a youth that has gone. That is obvious, isn't it, for all? Which is why so many women, particularly women, across the world spend so much money and effort and time and energy on plastic surgery so that somehow they can get back that sense of youthfulness again. They talk about lifting and stretching and all the rest of it because they can't cope with the loss. In some sense, there is also some sense of loss, either because they count the loss of never having had children, which is now past, or they see empty days and empty homes where once children filled their time and took their energy. They can't do what once they did. Running up and down the stairs 25 times a day is just too much of a challenge now, and 5 is enough. Their energy has gone. And the frustration at unfulfilled dreams, similar to the men, can all too easily lead them to bitterness, which finds a highly destructive outlet, as we're going to see. If you are an older woman, then I don't doubt that you can relate to some of what I've just said, which I'm assured is correct. And to people in this situation, Paul says that knowing Jesus Christ as Lord makes a whole world of difference on your view of the world and of yourself. Likewise, he says in verse 3, teach the older women to be, well, to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. That first characteristic, that first one, the reverent that Titus is to teach, is actually a really complicated word. It's the only occasion on which that word that Paul uses in the original language of Greek that he wrote this, it's the only occasion on which it occurs in the New Testament. Literally, Paul says that older women are to be taught to be properly sacred. So,
unusual is the word, and so poignant is the phraseology that, again, some commentators, as they discuss this, have kind of pointed to temple service as that kind of reverence. Titus, and certainly the Cretans, there's no way they could have understood that. So Paul can't have meant that. But you get the idea, don't you? There is a sense in which an older woman particularly, says Paul, is to see herself in an entirely different light. To be properly sacred. That is, women who are serving their God, conscious of their service to Him. If they name Jesus Christ as Lord with all the energy that they put into bringing up kids and serving family and loving and looking after and entertainment and hospitality and all, suddenly their service's priority has changed. And they've got to see it in relationship with God. To fill those potentially empty days, they must not busy themselves with, says Paul, with two things that are really quite extreme. One is slander or gossip. And the other is to be enslaved, to be addicted to much wine. Those might sound rather extreme. And perhaps they are somewhat of a comment on Cretan society. But if you stop and think for a moment about our own society, I think you'll find that those things fit really rather neatly. Just think about some of the soaps on TV and the way they portray older women. I understand. Think about some of the magazines that fill our bookshelves that I see queuing up to get the milk. How else do you think Hello magazine ever got off the ground if it's not the constant desire for the business of others and gossip? If you want to know someone else's business, who are you going to ask? Well, society would say probably an older woman will know. To have a gossip is even become a term of endearment. I remember a few years ago, somebody actually talking to somebody about the whole subject of gossip, and them looking me straight in the face and saying, "But what's wrong with a good gossip? It's fun." It is, unless you're on the receiving end of it. And an illustration was told some years ago of actually a local Anglican vicar about whom somebody had spread some malicious gossip in the village. And after some time, he was able to go to them and challenge the gossip. And they said that they were sorry. But so that they might understand the consequences of what they did, he took them with him up the tower in the church. It was one of those village churches with a great big tower at the top. And he took with him, much to their confusion, a big feather pillow. Some of you will have heard this illustration before, but it bears telling again. And he said to them, "Now listen. I want you to understand, and the only way you're going to understand is to watch." And at the top of the tower, he tore open the pillow and he flapped it out the window. And of course, the tower high up across the village, the feathers went for miles and miles and miles. And then he turned to the gossip and said, "Now I want you to go and pick up every one of those." "But there's no way I can do that," said the gossip. "You're right," said the vicar. "You can't. And the result of what you said will go on and on and on for years. Don't do it again." It is the sign of an empty life, isn't it? When people can only fill their time with talking about other people's business. Of course, it doesn't just apply to women. Far from it. In our covenant of fellowship, in our what we sign up, those of us that are members of our church, what we sign up to say in the way we will behave towards one another, it says very clearly that we will not gossip. Why? Because it's a basic Christian virtue. But Paul reckons that it's one of those things that particularly older women are in danger of falling into, as apparently is a sign of drowning sorrows when alcoholism takes over where godliness should be. You see, instead of filling their lives with these things, older women are to teach those things which are good. Literally, he says, those things which are beautiful. We're going to see next week the practical outworking of older women's teaching. But can I encourage you to stop and think for a moment about the way he's worked this through? Be content that if you count yourself an older woman, the way you live out Jesus Christ as Lord is that you are to be looking for opportunities to
encourage other people, to build up other people in godliness rather than tear them down. If you are an older woman and you find you have more time than otherwise once you did, then use that time treating Jesus as Lord. That's what Paul says. Not with these other things that the rest of the world does, but building up in godliness. Encouraging others rather than criticizing them. Again, for those who are older women and for those who will one day be, can I exhort you humbly to pray these virtues in and live them out? Because you've got so much to give. And can you see why he's put these things this way? Both to older men and to young and to older women, and later next week to younger men and to younger women. Can you see that the truth of knowing Jesus Christ as Lord doesn't just mean Christians have to earn their way to heaven for these things? Far from it. But the reality is that they can live out in the right direction what it means for them, him to be their Lord. And the world will see. Look at how he puts it in verse 5. Why do these things? Well, so that no one will malign the word of God. Verse 8. Why do these things? So that those who oppose you may be ashamed, because they have nothing bad to say about us. Why do these things? Verse 10. So that the teaching about God our Savior will be presented as attractive in every way. Why do these things? Because Jesus Christ is Lord. And if he's Lord of us, he's Lord of all. Every part of our lives, everything that we do, and the world should see that at work.